Hello and a very warm welcome to our podcast, The Sound of Economics Today. My name is Guntram Wolf and I'm the director of Bruegel, and I'm joined today by Vera Songwe. Vera Songwe is the executive secretary of the United Nations Economic Commission for Africa, based in Ethiopia. Originally, Vera is from Cameroon, and she holds a PhD from the University of Leuven in Belgium, so very close to where I'm currently located. And it's a real pleasure to discuss with you today. We want to discuss about how the world has handled the pandemic and, you know, what's going to be next and how we ensure that this pandemic is getting under control. And of course, we want to hear, Vera, your special perspective on this from your part of the world. And let me also mention that to our audience, we are both sitting in a so-called high-level independent panel, which was appointed by the Italian G20 presidency, where we discuss exactly these issues. And one special issue we discuss is how to ensure the necessary financing is available to deal with this pandemic, but also to deal with future pandemics, meaning dealing, preventing it, preparing for them, and if they occur, responding to them. But today we really want to focus on where we are at the moment and what's going to be next, and, you know, what should be done at this stage from the point of view of you, Vera, sitting where you sit. So, Vera, thanks for joining. And why don't you tell us what's your thinking currently about this issue?
So thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you, Guntram, for this conversation. I think, yes, as you said, we sit on this high-level independent panel appointed by the G20 presidency to think a little bit about how we respond. We are experiencing, and we being the global we, the whole world, the global economy, is going through, I think, something we have never experienced before. This is not even akin to the Great Depression, right? This is a systemic, collective, sudden stop in all of our economies. We woke up one morning and things we had never imagined before were happening. Our economies were shut down. Our streets were empty. Times Square had nobody in it. Nigeria's markets were thinned out. So essentially, the global nature of this crisis requires a global response. And that's why institutions like the G20, which are slightly more inclusive, are responding to this. But Africa has not had the same kinds of ammunition to respond to this crisis as everybody else has. When we started, got into the crisis, Africa was doing well. We were not doing as well as we can. Africa needs to be growing at 7 to 10% every year to be able to reduce poverty as fast as it needs to. But when we look at the data over the last 10 years, you know, many African countries have seen not their GDP, but their GDP per capita. And I want to emphasize GDP per capita because that's really what's relevant. GDP per capita is what everybody takes home, right? It's the individual level of us, not just the economy. But GDP per capita in many of these countries had gone up. And we were sort of feeling comfortable. Ethiopia, Rwanda, you know, had seen, you know, some of the fastest accelerations in GDP per capita in the last decade. Then the crisis hit. I think it's taken a lot of us back. But what we needed as Africa was liquidity. And I think that this diagnostic is not a novel diagnostic, because this is what the rest of the developed world, the advanced economies, did for themselves. Immediately the crisis hit, because we had learned from 2008, we were able to immediately hit the markets. Central banks poured in $7 trillion in the first 2 months of the crisis. Advanced economy central banks poured $7 trillion worth of liquidity into the advanced economies. And I say this just so that we can digest it. The developing economies, frontier economies, Africa, Latin America, and East Asia, were struggling because we don't have hard currency. We didn't have the same kinds of tools. East Asia eventually, a lot, you know, on the back of Japan, was able to get some access to more liquidity. But Africa has been asking for somewhere in the order of $100 billion to just, you know, fill that liquidity space. Because the African governments did the right thing. From Benin to Cote d'Ivoire to Kenya, countries said, private sector, don't pay taxes. You know, there was forbearance. The same kind of forbearance that happened in Switzerland. In Switzerland, all mortgage homeowners were told, don't pay your mortgage for the next 3 months. So this is not something new. This is something that was happening in the United States, the same thing. They still to this day have forbearance programs for mortgages and interest. Banks themselves were given forbearance by the Fed. And so the African economies were saying, can we get a little bit of this kind of forbearance? And the G20 was gracious enough And they sort of provided what we are now calling the debt service suspension initiative that allowed us some liquidity, but only 5 billion.
Before we zoom in a little bit more on this issue of debt and what we can do with debt overhang, as well as, of course, the liquidity needs, I wanted to push you a bit more on the health side of the whole situation, because as the pandemic hit, there were initially quite a number of reports suggesting that Africa was not so strongly hit by the pandemic. But then there were others suggesting that that might be just an artifact of less testing or perhaps a younger population. Can you just update us where you see the infection at the moment in Africa? Because without controlling the pandemic, it will be very difficult to start our economies again.
And again, this is the other part of, I think, the global nature of this crisis, right? We need to, all of us together need to control our economies. And just to go back to your question in particular, today on the continent, we have about 4 million, a little bit over, maybe from Wednesday. So yesterday, we have about 4.08 million affected and about a million or 900 and something that have passed away because of this crisis and the health side. So when you look at the numbers and you think 4 million, it doesn't sound huge. A lot of the affected population has come essentially from South Africa, Morocco, Algeria, Egypt. So essentially our head and our sort of, you know, the tips of our continent have been the ones that have suffered the brunt, particularly of the first wave. Then we had a second wave. So in the first wave, which is your question, one of the things that happened is maybe because of the panic, and we were all watching, I think in those days, everybody was glued to their phones, shocked, you know, that the Colosseum was empty, that, you know, at the airports in Dubai and Ethiopia were thinning out. And so people stayed home. And Africa, essentially, as Europe was doing its lockdown as well. And we believe that Africa may have locked down too early, but it helped because it brought the sort of fear and the magnitude of the crisis to bay. Almost 49 African countries closed down their economies in those sort of pre-3 weeks of the crisis. And I think what that did was it protected us from the first wave. We closed down economies, churches, all sort of gatherings were locked down. By the time we were getting into Christmas time, people had been in lockdowns of different sorts for very, very long. And so, like everywhere else, by the way, you know, we had a little bit of a spike, but now we are seeing an even deeper spike in a third wave. And we believe that as we are all seeing, there are new strands which appear to be a lot faster contaminating. They may not have the same rates of mortality. So in a place like Ethiopia, where a man's responding to you, we did very well. We congratulated Ethiopia in the beginning of the crisis, but now we are at about 20% of the testing. Now, the second thing is you're supposed to test about 100 per every 10,000 of your population.
Right.
At the best, we got to about 23 countries that were doing that. So yes, we did not test like everybody else. So those numbers are not as good because only 23 countries, somewhere in the middle of the crisis, in March, April, May, June, sometime in the period between May and July, we got to 23 countries testing 100 for every 10,000 members of their population. That number has since gone back down because people are expecting vaccines and people are getting a little bit exhausted. But we are clearly seeing Kenya has gone back into a lockdown. Senegal, we are seeing a little bit of a sort of containment. So again, I think there is a little bit of a resurgence on the continent.
Okay, talking a bit about more the sort of economic side and the balance of payment side, the liquidity side, the debt side, but also the necessary funding to contain the pandemic and ensure that also vaccines are there. I mean, these are sort of three big topics which we can perhaps quickly take in turn. I mean, if you can just say a few words on the balance of payment side and, you know, basically the liquidity support that is still needed. I mean, one of the remarkable things that I find quite remarkable in this pandemic is that, you know, we are now 1 year into this major pandemic and we still don't have sort of any country that has had a massive balance of payment crisis where sort of the globe would have woken up and said, okay, I mean, a huge sort of external financing gap. And so the IMF gave some support, but some argue that that was too little too late. And of course, the liquidity by the central banks in the advanced economies helped a lot, also provide liquidity in the global economy. So where do you see currently the leads more on the liquidity side? Where are we in your part of the world?
So in Africa, which is my part of the world, we still have huge liquidity needs. just on Monday, I was talking with the Minister of Finance of Egypt. And when we talk about liquidity needs for the people that are listening to us, it may sound sort of very highfalutin, but it essentially means that for many businesses, if you take a country like Egypt, where 17% of Egypt's revenue was coming from trade in the Suez Canal and almost 45% of trade stopped because of the crisis, and another 15% or so was coming from tourism and planes stopped flying, essentially, even with the best macroeconomic management, they've lost revenue. But it's temporary, we know that. And that's why we need liquidity, because that additional revenue that they have lost was the resources that they were using to ensure that those who are at the bottom of the economic scale get the right social safety nets, for example. Those who needed health services are able to get fund health services. But also we need some additional liquidity to help small and medium enterprises in all of our economies, including the developed economies, by the way. Over 70% of the economy is made up of small and medium enterprises. They need liquidity, even if they are switching production for working capital to start doing masks. People move from doing skirts to doing masks, right? But you still need the additional investment. That's why we're talking about liquidity. It's for three things. It's to keep the investment, the productive sectors of the economy still open. It's to make sure that those that have fallen down into poverty have a safety net that is supporting them. And third is to make sure that we can continue to ensure that we can import, because a lot of the liquidity also comes as foreign exchange. So we need foreign exchange to buy even vaccines. And that's your third point. As you know, only 1% of Africa has been able to have access to the vaccines, whereas we're talking about 23 million in the UK already vaccinated, and the US, and thank God, are vaccinating at almost 2 million a day. Whereas the continent, no country has reached those numbers. Morocco has vaccinated 11%, and Seychelles maybe 60%, but Seychelles is a small economy with less than 500,000 people. So I think that's why we're looking for liquidity. And that the link between liquidity and insolvency, as you said, no African country has collapsed. There has not been any balance of payment shock, because before the crisis, 2019, we had good buffers. Our revenues were not at 30%, but they were going up. You know, we had countries already at 19, 20, 25% in South Africa. Egypt had taken and put in place serious macroeconomic reforms. They were beginning to grow from 2% to 7%. Ethiopia, where I'm sitting, was looking at growing at 8, 9%. So we did have actually vibrant economies. This shock, and we must always remember, is an external shock. It's not a policy domestic induced shock. It's an external shock. So even when you see today countries like Ethiopia and Zambia and Chad that are taking the G20 common framework, which is a debt resolution process, the reason they're doing that is that they may have one bullet payment into the markets coming, and they need to restructure it. So they don't really have a debt problem. They have a solvency problem, and they have a bullet payment that's due. And we do need to look at that. But secondly, I think the solvency problem will start coming out in the second half of 2021, and most especially if we don't get liquidity quickly in 2022. But just to compare and contrast, the United States just gave itself $1.9 trillion of stimulus. And then we all woke up yesterday morning to another $2 trillion of fiscal stimulus into infrastructure, into growth. Two things are going to happen with that kind of policy, if the policy is only cloistered around the advanced economies, is that we are not the frontier economies in Africa in particular, we're not getting any help. But because you're injecting so much liquidity into your own economies, we're going to start feeling the heat from exchange rate rising, from interest rate costs rising, and then we will get into a crisis. So we will not only have been hit by COVID and by an economic recession, but by also excessive stimulus in the advanced economies with nothing to the rest of us. And I think we need to look at that as well and make sure that some of those interlinkages are taken care of. And that's why the IMF has done a study that says that to bring frontier economies, low-income economies, African economies back to catching up or closing the gap on sort of the differences, we need $425 billion of additional liquidity to African economies and the other developing economies. That's why we are asking for that. And I think that's why it's important. And if we do that, then we can manage some of this balance of payment crises that we are seeing. I take an example in the case of vaccines, which is a good example. The African Union and the African heads of states came together in January 1 and passed what we call the African Continental Free Trade Area Agreement. essentially saying Africa is going to trade with itself, we're going to do more, we're going to do better. But all that gets difficult because we cannot invest. But one thing that's happening, which is interesting, but which shows the interlinkages between our economies, is that the African Union on Tuesday just announced huge agreement between Johnson & Johnson and the African Union to supply over $200 million worth of vaccines. Do you know where those vaccines are going to be produced? In South Africa.
Yeah, very little in Africa. The overall production capacity in Africa is extremely limited for vaccines, which is, I think, one of the things we really need to think about, because, of course, vaccine nationalism is what every politician will want to do in a crisis, because he or she has to be accountable to the voters that vote for him. And so if you concentrate all production in just a few places, you really have a problem. I think it's quite striking how little capacity for producing vaccines is actually on the African continent.
I think this is one of the positives of the crisis, that we have realized that we consume over 60% of the vaccines of the world and we produce less than 1%. And so there is now a huge move towards seeing how we can, you know, increase production on the continent. We already have some production in South Africa, in Senegal, and in Egypt. We hope that we can now, you know, create more production capacity.
So perhaps in conclusion, if we can say a few words about what you think we should take away from the current experience for future pandemic preparedness and response. What do you think are the key issues in terms of mobilizing finance, both for preparedness, meaning steady flow of money every year, being sure that countries do the necessary investments, are prepared for the pandemic, as well as the surge funding. So in times of crisis, make sure that the funding is there so that the protective equipment can be quickly bought, that the vaccines can be developed quickly, that the vaccines can be produced and distributed. Where do you see the key priorities on these issues that we draw from the current COVID crisis, which in many respects is a relatively mild pathogen, right? It's not that deadly. It's not that contagious. One could think of a pandemic with much worse characteristics than this one. And so in a sense, what this one teaches us is really to be better prepared and to learn. And so I would like to get your perspective on what should we do to be better prepared for the next pandemic.
That's a fantastic question. I think, as somebody used to say, we shouldn't let a crisis go to waste, right? And one of the things that we should do is, look, it's taken us a year to get a new issuances of special drawing rights, which is essentially, you know, new liquidity to the whole world. What we've seen is a liquidity nationalism, if you want to call it that. Everybody that could give themselves liquidity has given themselves liquidity until a year later. We've said, now let's give everybody liquidity. Maybe what we need to do is, we have some instruments that already exist, the special drawing rights. You have a crisis like this, let's immediately issue special drawing rights. But I think one of the other things that we need to look at is the allocation of the special drawing rights. Today, we see that it wouldn't go to the most vulnerable countries. And again, the second thing we need to look at is, in pandemics, we need to look at the definition of countries. What we've tended to do, which was half of the right thing, was we said, oh, let's go help the low-income countries. But in a pandemic like this, it was not necessarily the low-income countries that got the brunt of the problem. We have some middle-income countries, some small island states, whose economies depended 70% on tourism, who are worse off than low-income agriculture economies that continue to function. So I think we also need to look at, by pandemic, if we issue special drawing rights, should they then be aligned to some kind of a vulnerability index, so that we can then ensure that those who are the most hurt by that problem can be the ones that get the first support? So I think these are questions, of course, that the IMF, and I must say, has been already doing a really fantastic job, is already looking at. And so we hope that we can find some global infrastructure architecture that is able to do that, is inject liquidity quickly, but inject liquidity quickly that responds to the crisis at hand. This is a health crisis. It has affected a particular set of vulnerable economies. If we get the next crisis, maybe a climate crisis, and it may affect a whole different set of countries. And we cannot then say, oh, let's just run to low-income countries and help them. We will need to then look at maybe small island states, or those who are the most affected by climate. And the next one may be a cybersecurity crisis. And it may be the most connected countries that will be affected. So I think it's issue immediately some liquidity to the global economy, and then get some kind of a vulnerability index that ensures that it's those who are the most affected that get the help the first.
Wonderful. So it's really a strong plea for some sort of a global insurance system, which helps those that are most affected by whatever crisis comes up. And I think indeed you mentioned three very clear crises that we are all can be faced with, both the pandemic health crisis, the climate crisis, as well as, of course, IT and cyber crisis, that the risk of which is completely underestimated at the moment. Thank you so much, Vera Songwe, for joining us today on The Sound of Economics. And thank you, listeners, for listening to our podcast today. If you would like to learn more about these and other topics, go to our website, www.bruegel.org, and do share the podcast with your friends if you liked it. Thanks so much for joining, Vera, and thanks to us so much for being here with us, our audience. Bye-bye.
Thank you to the audience. Stay safe. Go get vaccinated. It is safe.